What we used to think of as science fiction is very close to science fact in our time, where writers used to imagine acts of war committed with the push of a button from a great distance. That's no longer imagination. The click of a mouse can launch a drone, sure. But we now have warfare that does not involve any shooting or blowing up. Why use gunpowder or fissile material when you can just hit enter and release computer code that destroys the computer systems and all they operate in some other country? We get a sense of how far down this road we've gone in David Sanger's book, The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. David Sanger, a national security correspondent for the New York Times, regular contributor to CNN. Three times he was part of a team at the Times that won Pulitzer Prizes. He's the author of two previous books, and in his spare time teaches national security at Harvard. David Sanger, welcome.
Great to be with you, Jeff.
How concerned were you that by the time the book came out, something new would happen?
Pretty concerned. So concerned, in fact, that when I do my books as the readers of the past two, The Inheritance and Confront and Conceal, will know. I don't allow the publisher more than 5 or 6 weeks between the time we're done editing and the time we get them on the shelves because, boy, in this world, you can get overtaken by events pretty quickly. And in the cyber field, especially, because it's every few weeks that we read about another major cyber attack. It's every day that you see more minor ones. And the effort of the book was to try to explain to people that these aren't just sort of the random happenings of just cyber criminals trying to get your credit card data, that frequently Americans and others find themselves the collateral damage in a war, a state-on-state war in cyberspace that's taking place just below the level at which it would prompt military responses, and that that's happening every day, and we're all sort of caught in the middle of it.
So we've switched from fear of a nuclear attack to something else, and in this realm you don't need big weapons or explosives, just computers and hackers.
Well, there's some merger over. I mean, one of the many revelations in the book is that the United States engaged in a fairly lengthy effort to disrupt North Korea's missile test launches just in recent years. Seemed successful until the fall of 2016 when Kim Jong-un changed the kind of design he was using because he suspected that his 88% missile test failure rate might have something to do with the United States. But that's not the only example. The last book, Confront and Conceal, of course, was known for what we revealed about President Bush and President Obama's roles in Olympic Games, which was the code name for the program to destroy Iran's nuclear centrifuges underground using a sophisticated cyber weapon. And what this book does, Jeff, is it takes you up to date from Olympic Games, which known to most people as the Stuxnet virus, to what happened since, which was an unleashing of cyber attacks by many more countries around the world. By my estimate, there are now 30 to 40 countries capable of launching sophisticated cyber attacks. When I wrote the last book 6 years ago, we couldn't find another attack, sophisticated attack like Olympic Games. In working on this one, stopped counting at probably 200 or 250.
Get a sense in the first few pages of the preface that the United States is behind, at least in defending itself. Is that a fair characterization, or is that hard to pin down?
No, it's a very fair characterization. We are the best in the world at cyber offense, not by much. The Chinese and the Russians are right behind us, and the Iranians and the North Koreans, as everybody who's been watching this on TV can see, have been getting better and better and better. But in defense, we've got a much more complex problem than most countries do. Because in cyber, the country that's always on the back heel is the most connected society. So that would be us. And the fact that we are so dependent on the Internet for everything, from your Internet-connected radios to your Internet-connected car, to your internet-connected refrigerator. I still haven't figured out why I need an internet-connected refrigerator.
To tell you to buy milk.
Maybe if it tells me stop eating, you know. But we have, our dependency on connectivity has grown so much faster than our defense capability has grown that we're far more vulnerable now than we were 10 years ago. not because we've gotten worse at cybersecurity. We've actually gotten better. I mean, most people have two-factor authentication now, you know, that bit where the bank sends you a six-digit number to your phone that you have to go type in before you can take money out of your account, things like that. But because our vulnerabilities, the target area, has grown so much faster than our defenses have grown. So you're right, we're behind, and we don't have a theory of deterrence here. It took years in the nuclear world to develop a deterrence theory. We dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, and in the late 50s and early 60s, the concepts of MAD, mutually assured destruction, were still being worked out. So that was, you know, 15 years plus. But those methods of deterrence that work in the atomic world do not work in the cyber world. And so we're struggling to try to figure out how do you deter attacks when you can't see them coming, when the main targets are in the private sector, not in the public, when it becomes so easy over time and so cheap to launch these attacks.
Plus, there's all the deniability, and it really does make it the perfect weapon, which, not surprisingly, is the title of David Sanger's book, subtitled War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. Maybe we're not doing duck and cover drills under our desks anymore, but boy, sometimes our computers and the things that they're capable of controlling do scare us, and with good reason. We'll hear more from David Sanger, and you can join the conversation by phone or by email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange to talk more about the perfect weapon in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is David Sanger, a national security correspondent for the New York Times, regular contributor to CNN. He's out with a fairly recent book indicating just how dangerous countries have become to one another and each other's citizenry through operations in the computer realm. The things that we can do to turn off each other's computer systems and cause great havoc in society has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. The book is called The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. You can join the conversation. You may have many questions. I still do. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Before we get into some specifics, David, I just want to ask about the whole level of secrecy involving this. I mean, can we even have a good debate about what we know? And if we did, do we even have politicians nimble enough to have a debate about the level of technology?
You raise a really great question, Jeff. So the secrecy surrounding cyber is even greater than the secrecy that surrounded our nuclear arsenal. I mean, back in the 50s, you'll remember that there was a debate about whether or not we should use nuclear weapons against North Korea, against China in the Korean War. There was then a very big debate in the 60s and 70s about whether or not we should actually restrict the use of nuclear weapons to just matters of national survival, which is sort of where the debate ended up. We haven't even begun that debate in cyber weapons. And the reason is that while in nuclear, we managed to keep everything secret about the specifics of the weapons and yet still have a debate about how to go use them. The government's view in nuclear, in cyber, is that even to discuss our capabilities is to help out our adversaries. Now, I think that's gotten a little bit ridiculous, and I would argue, in fact, that what's happened now is that the United States is getting in the way of its own deterrent capability by its refusal first to discuss its capabilities and warn other countries what the retaliation might look like, but also because of our reluctance to put limits on how we would use them and how others might use them. So we've gotten in our own way. You raise a very good question about politicians. You know, I can't tell you how many times in the course of a decade on reporting on cyber and national security issues for the New York Times that I've run into politicians who still think it's funny or cute to say, oh, I don't understand this stuff, but, you know, my grandchildren do, or something like that. And you kind of want to sort of say to them, gee, if you were in office in the 50s, would it have been acceptable to say, I don't understand much about nuclear physics, but my grandkids do, so I'll let them think about the weapons?
Huh.
I don't think that would have worked. So we need to come way up the learning curve. There are some members of Congress who are quite sophisticated on these issues. Will Hurd from Texas, who used to be a CIA officer. You've seen many members of the Intelligence Committee from the California area get pretty sophisticated on these issues. But by and large, I would say most of the Congress views this as something too hard for them to understand, so they're not going to bother.
Wow. All right. So let's step back in time now, because there's a great cautionary tale in the book that just sort of leads up into how people use their imaginations for the uses of new inventions. And it's about the Wright brothers demonstrating their plane in Washington, D.C., in front of President Taft and a lot of other people in 1909. And the descriptions of the way that people view the plane for how it could be used for military purposes, is it's almost funny. But the fact is that our use of aircraft in war increased in staggeringly fast a rollout.
Yeah, the parallels to cyber are pretty strong, and I put that early in the book so that people stopped thinking about nuclear as the best analogy and began thinking about the aircraft. So, as you said, in 1909, the Wright brothers brought out their military flyer, which was basically a version of the Wright brothers' plane that they were designing to sell to militaries around the world in hopes of not going broke, which, of course, was their constant problem as they were trying to get the airplane going. And so they showed it up in College Park, Maryland, to a bunch of Army generals who looked at it and said, this is terrific. We can fly this up over enemy lines and see their vulnerabilities and then send in the cavalry. You know, they're immediately thinking the war is going to be fought the old way. Right.
Right. So we'll take up the planes to allow us to bring in the horses.
That's right. That's basically it. And no one in the course of that discussion was really discussing arming the airplane. Well, by World War One, which started only 8 or 9 years later, you suddenly had, you know, the Red Baron and, you know, dogfights happening. By World War Two, we had consistent air battles, and then leading to the development of the Enola Gay, a B-29, that then delivered an atomic bomb. Well, of course, at the time that the Wright brothers were showing off their airplane, no one could imagine an atomic bomb because it hadn't yet been invented. And that's the humility to which we have to come to cyber, because we understand a bit about how the messages and electrons move and how they get into systems that they're not supposed to be in. But we're at the early days of the development of the payload, the actual weapons themselves, which is why it's so scary that the National Security Agency lost so many of its weapons a few years ago to insiders, not in the Snowden case, but in a lesser-known case that followed, in which the weapons, many of them, and the vulnerabilities they exploited were published by a group that we believe was linked to the Russians called the Shadow Brokers. And to this day, a lot more people have heard about Snowden, but the shadow brokers did far more damage because they released the actual code.
David Sanger is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, national security correspondent for the New York Times. His book is called The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. One of the first cyber attacks you mentioned in the book was on Ukraine's electrical grid. What happened there?
Well, Ukraine is described in the book in a chapter I call Putin's Petri Dish, because it's where he experiments on everything. And everything that happened to the United States in 2016 and the election and beyond happened first in Ukraine. It's the Russian testing ground. So in the Ukraine, there have been a bunch of different attacks. There were, as you note, two different attacks on sectors of the electrical grid that turned off the lights and put them under foreign control in 2015 and 2016, both at Christmas time. And while the country recovered from them, it was an effort by the Russians to say, we can own the system whenever we need to. Worth remembering when you hear those Department of Homeland Security warnings about Russian implants in the American electrical grid. So that's one set. But it didn't stop there. The Russians got into the election reporting system and nearly got the Ukrainian media to report the wrong results in a presidential election, flipping it to the pro-Russian candidate. They've gotten at various points into Facebook accounts and so forth so that they could feed the divisions inside Ukrainian society between the Russian-speaking part and the non-Russian-speaking part. What's this all sound like?
Well, it sounds like what they did to us in 2016.
Sure it does.
It's confirmed by the intelligence services.
That's right. That's right.
Wow. So it was essentially happening to us at the same time.
It was later on. It happened in Ukraine first. We paid attention to the electrical grid part of this because we sent a group of people from the Department of Energy and others out to examine what lessons could be learned from the Russian attacks on the Ukrainian grid. But we couldn't imagine that the kinds of things that they were doing in the election system they would dare to do to us. Well, they did.
Huh, that's interesting. So there's a level of they wouldn't try that with us, but they would.
And it gets worse, Jeff, because what else did we discover? There were attacks prior to the Democratic National Committee attack on the White House, on the State Department, and on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. These were pretty sophisticated attacks on largely unclassified email systems in which the NSA had to spend weeks, for example, getting the Russians out of the White House email system. The Russians kept coming back in just again to prove that they could. So what happened after that? The Obama administration did not name the Russians publicly as the country that came in and did this, again, back to the secrecy issues we discussed, and did not make them pay a price. So if you're Vladimir Putin and you're thinking, okay, they're not willing to do much when we go into the White House and the State Department and the Joint Chiefs computer systems, who's going to care about the Democratic National Committee, which is essentially staffed by college kids? So they basically saw this as a free fire zone. And I use this to make the argument that we've done a pretty terrible job of making countries believe that they're going to pay a price for something, even if it's below an act of war, but that they would pay a price of some kind.
Because of fear of revealing vulnerabilities in our system or admitting that we have been vulnerable?
That's right. And because of the embarrassment and also because of the sense that, well, this was more espionage. And we do espionage, they do espionage, you know, shame on us for letting it happen. But, of course, once the Russians got into the DNC, it may have started as an espionage operation. It ended up as an influence operation as they released those emails to try to affect the actual outcome of the election. Now, that isn't to say, and your readers, your listeners who are hearing this should take a deep breath, I don't find any evidence that they succeeded in changing votes. Maybe they did, but you'd have to crawl into the minds of different voters who might have been weighing Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton to know that, but certainly we have not, in the year and a half since the big investigations to the Russia hack began, sort of step back and say, we need a big national commission that looks at these issues and makes the decision about what lessons we need to learn to make sure no foreign country ever does this again. And we're not doing it because President Trump has basically taken the position that any admission of the Russians acting in this arena could make people believe he's not legitimately elected as president. And he wants to obviously avoid that at all costs.
David Sanger is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a national security correspondent for the New York Times, regular contributor to CNN, three times part of teams that won Pulitzer Prizes at the Times. His latest book is called The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. You may have many questions. Bring them to us at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go back to the Wright brothers example where you know, some people in the military realized, hey, with a plane, we could do reconnaissance. And other people realized with a plane, we could drop a bomb. So have we fully realized, do you think, David, all the bad things we can do?
Well, we certainly have a lot of parts of the U.S. government that are working on offensive capabilities. and defenses. United States Cyber Command just became a full command, just like Special Operations Command is, and Northern Command, and Pacific Command. And it now has 6,200 trained, up, ready, combat-ready cyber warriors working for it. One of their first projects was to plan for an attack on Iran called Nitro Zeus that only would have happened if we had gone to war with Iran in a conflict after, if the nuclear deal didn't come together in 2015. That may be being revived at some point now that that nuclear deal, of course, is history. But the key point is that cyber is now fully built into every American war plan. And it's fully built into those war plans for obvious reasons, because you would want to try to start and stop a war before you fired a single shot. The difficulty is it's also built into our rivals' war plans. And so, of course, we could end up becoming the example where the first attacks are on civilian infrastructure that is attacked via cyber means. And, of course, in a world that's everything's connected, that means the utilities, the financial markets, the cell phone markets, the cell phone networks, anything that you can get at by getting at the control systems.
Which, okay, so this brings up another question then that has often nagged at me. It's one thing to put your life into your phone and make sure that all your information is right there in one thing that fits in the palm of your hand. But if you're a utility company, you're a bank, you're any large organization that needs to make sure that your systems are robust and continue to operate, why do you even have the ability for people to reach your control systems via the internet?
Well, frequently you don't. You try to wall them off and create something called an air gap. That means that your computer systems are not on the internet. They're only reachable through control systems inside your own control rooms. The problem with this is that sooner or later those systems have to be updated. People have to have access to them in some way. There's physical access to them. Insiders have access to them. I remind people that Iran separated all of the computer networks that were running its Natanz nuclear enrichment site away from the internet back in 10 years ago. And yet the United States mounted, and Israel mounted, a very successful attack against it because they got inside using USB cards and other things, sending things in true human beings.
Well, that's the really interesting part to me is that it's not just an internet thing. And for it's how the Russians got into our CIPRNet that connects the military and intelligence services and the White House through a really rather ingenious, devilishly clever sort of routine.
That's right. They left empty or seemingly empty USB keys around the parking lot of some military facilities in the Middle East. And people picked them up and put them in their computers, and then their computers got connected to some other computer, and the next thing they knew, they were inside. I mentioned before the shadow brokers, the Russian use of American weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We think in one case, an NSA worker who took material home that he wasn't supposed to take home, was classified, put it on his laptop computer. As it turned out, his laptop computer was using Kaspersky virus protection. And virus protection programs, of course, can get anywhere in your computer because they're there to root out a virus that may be coming in. That Kaspersky software, made in Russia, detected, we believe, the code names of some U.S. programs and began funneling that information, unbeknownst to the guy who brought it out, we believe, out to Russian servers.
Wow. So this is why the people who are involved in cybersecurity have to really consider all the places that stuff goes, where the people go, where the hardware goes.
I'll give you another good example, Jeff, of where the stuff goes. So, of course, the U.S. government has locked down the Pentagon and the CIA, all the obvious places where your computer systems would be vulnerable. But what about the Office of Personnel Management, the most boring bureaucracy in Washington? And that's saying a lot, right? And it turns out they were the custodians of all of the reports that people have to give, the very detailed reports when they apply for a security clearance. And this is more than just your birth date and your Social Security number. It's everybody you knew. It's your past relationships and all that. Those got stored on computer systems that were at the Department of the Interior, which just had some extra space. And the Chinese came in and got all of it, 22 million files, fingerprints on 5 million Americans, to begin to build a database of what Americans with security clearances are working on.
Wow. All right, you can see again why the title of the book is The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. We can wage war through computer systems quite easily, as David Sanger points out over and over in the book. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange with The Perfect Weapon and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is David Sanger, a national security correspondent for the New York Times, author of several books. His latest is called The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. We've reached the point in the world where why bother with all the big bombs and planes and guns when you can just hire a couple of guys who are really good with computers and get them to hack into another country and shut down their power grid, their banking system, things like that. This is the point we've reached in the world. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned some of the United States' offensive moves against Iran, the Stuxnet virus and its use targeting the centrifuges that were enriching uranium for a potential Iranian bomb. David, is that part of what got the Iranians to negotiate the agreement that that was made with the Obama administration?
I think it was. There's no way to measure it, but it was the combination of sanctions and sabotage that I think brought them to the table, because the sanctions made it clear to them that they couldn't export unless they reached an agreement. And the sabotage made clear to them that the United States was inside their system and would do everything they could to sabotage it along the way. What the mix of that was, hard to know. But this was the first sophisticated use of a cyber weapon by one state against another. And it led President Obama in Situation Room conversations to muse aloud that, you know, when this got out, and he knew eventually it would, that other states, even those that were going to use cyber weapons anyway, would use it as an excuse to mount their own attacks. And in fact, that's what's happened.
Well, so, and apparently there was some tension, not necessarily about Stuxnet, but about Nitro Zeus, which you mentioned earlier, a tension between the National Security Agency and the Military Cyber Command. What was the tension?
Well, there's been a lot of tension between the Cyber Command and the NSA. They are sister organizations. But the essential problem is that the NSA is there to do largely surveillance. Sometimes it does offensive cyber activity through the, what used to be called the Tailored Access Operations Unit. Those are the people who break into foreign systems. But if they put an implant in a foreign system, they want to nurture it along. They want to make sure that it stays well fed. It's like growing a bonsai, right? They want to make sure it's just right so that it can monitor the system for years and lurk in a system unseen. The Cyber Command people tend to want to take action with the system, turn it into a weapon, and use it for destructive purposes. Well, at the moment that you do that, you've exposed its location and thus made it impossible to use it in the future for surveillance. And so there's a built-in tension there. This is why NSA and Cyber Command right now report to a single commander who's the head of both organizations. That's likely to change next year as Cyber Command goes out on its own.
So, you know, as I think about the level of secrecy involved in here, and on one hand it makes sense, you don't want people to know what your offensive capabilities are, but on the other hand, I mean, there is certainly a level of public's right to know in here. But it seems like the secrecy can make for a perfect blend of the possible and the conspiracy theory.
It sure can, and it's one of the reasons that I think we've got to be out much more public about this, because we've got some big decisions to make. For example, let's say we wanted to set an international norm, Jeff, that said we won't attack election systems, we won't attack electoral electricity grids, we won't attack hospitals, we won't attack emergency services or cell phone networks. Okay, so you could imagine why that would be a good international norm that would make most civilians feel better in a sort of digital Geneva Convention, as the president of Microsoft, Brad Smith, calls it. Then imagine for a moment that you took those proposals to the American intelligence agencies, and you said, we're just about to negotiate this around the world. Well, they might stop and say, well, wait a minute there, Jeff. You know, we've messed with election systems before in Italy in 1948, and we've tried to maneuver elections in Iran in the 50s and Latin America in the 50s and 60s. Do you really want to cut yourself out of that business? And, of course, we have war plans that would cut off the electrical grid in lots of different countries. Do we want to keep that away from the president as an option, short of dropping weapons, dropping bombs? So I think there would be a big argument, even in the U.S., about whether or not to agree to these kinds of international norms.
We have a question here from Derek and Talent, or maybe it's a phone call anyway. Here is Derek and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Sanger, the author of The Perfect Weapon.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for taking my call, and I definitely have a question or two. I think the answer to David's hypothetical there, just my gut reaction, is the answer is yes. When you consider the bumper sticker, we're making enemies faster than we can kill them, I think we need to take pause and figure out how to wage more peace than war. And I hope this conclusion isn't pro-Space Force. And I guess I'd love to follow up if given the opportunity.
Okay, we're having a little trouble understanding you, but you're saying we're basically making enemies faster than we can kill them, and let's start with that point. So, David Sanger?
So, Derek makes a really interesting point, and it sort of goes back to the old Rumsfeld question about counterterrorism, which is, you know, if you drop a bomb on a terrorist location, but you end up killing some civilians along the way, are you creating new terrorists faster? And that's sort of the equivalent here. In this case, I think the question is the United States willing to give up some of its strategic advantage in order to set some norms that would protect Americans from a future unspecified cyber war? And the argument that the intelligence agencies will mount against that is, all rules are off in superpower conflict, so the Russians and the Chinese might sign up to this and they'd forget about it later on. Could be, but if you don't begin to set up some norms, then I agree with Derek, you're in a sort of war of all against all. And this is something we've got to go debate, and frankly, it's too important a debate to leave to just government officials and to be dominated by defense and intelligence officials.
So you were talking about a digital Geneva Convention. Are we anywhere near that? Are there any agreements that really govern anything in what we'll agree not to attack in each other's countries?
Well, a year ago, if you had asked me that question, Jeff, I would have said, yeah, we're making some progress. The United Nations had come to some agreements at the end of the Obama era that set some standards and so forth. But last summer, an effort to go take the next step collapsed. The Chinese and the Russians walked out on it. The Trump administration has not really taken this issue up. And more worrisome, the Trump administration has gotten rid of the position of cybersecurity coordinator. The cybersecurity coordinator was a job in the White House that was meant to go begin to bring together all of the different organizations that had different views on this. So the Department of Homeland Security, which does domestic defense, and the Department of Commerce, which, of course, has to think about keeping our economy up and running, and DOD and the intelligence agencies. And when John Bolton came in as the National Security Advisor, he eliminated that position. And it's not clear to me where or if those issues are even being debated in the Trump administration right now.
As long as we're talking about defensive capability and actual war stuff, Adam and Eugene had dropped off a question about, wants to know, in the first Iraq war, did the French attach a virus to the Iraqi radar system?
In the first Iraq war, it's not clear to me that the Iraqi radar system, he's talking, I think, about the Persian Gulf War.
To get Kuwait liberated.
Right, right. It's not clear to us that at that time systems were even connected to the kind of computer systems you would connect them to today. There was a lot of electronic warfare in the first Persian Gulf War, which is basically the interference of communication signals. But what we're discussing in the cyber realm is much more sophisticated than that. It's the actual connections between detailed computer systems that program weapon systems or program centrifuges and so forth, and then causing them through very subtle manipulation to act differently. So in the Olympic Games attack on the Iranian centrifuges, the centrifuges were actually spun up and spun down faster or slower than they were supposed to run until they got out of balance and destroyed themselves. And that was very hard for the Iranians to figure out whether this was a cyber attack or whether they had simply made some manufacturing errors and the equipment was just malfunctioning.
Let's make sure we give Edward Snowden his moment here. I mean, how did he get all the stuff he got? I mean, beyond access, I mean, how did he get all the encrypted stuff and why?
Most of it wasn't encrypted. He was inside the NSA system, and they did not encrypt their material. Then he used a $100 program called a web crawler that went around and swept up everything that was he had access to. He didn't even see most of it. It swept it up automatically, and then he fled with all of that. And the most amazing thing is the NSA didn't detect it. So then they put in a series of protections to keep that from happening again, and people walked out with the data we were discussing before, much more valuable data, actual source code of the weapons that was used in the shadow brokers.
So how much, I'm curious, particularly for you, David, and the work you do over the years in covering national security, how much did what Edward Snowden revealed confirm what you already suspected versus revealing a lot more?
It did reveal a fair bit. The revelations he kept talking about that he wanted to reveal were invasions of Americans' privacy, and while there were some operations he revealed that touched on that, most of the material he had nothing to do with the privacy of American citizens, but a lot to do with U.S. programs to go after China or Iran or North Korea or others. And so we learned a lot about the scope of the U.S. programs from what he revealed. And then in the next leaks, those shadow brokers leaks, the actual code got out, and that became dangerous because then the North Koreans took some of the published code, reformulated it into what they called the WannaCry attack, and that's the attack that took out the British healthcare system last year. So we've had our own weapons refashioned and shot back at us and our allies. If that had happened with missiles, there would have been a court-martial. Because it happened with cyber and it was complex to understand and easy for the U.S. government not to comment on, there have been no repercussions that we can find.
Wow, that too hard to understand thing, it doesn't work any better within the security establishment than it should for members of Congress, it seems.
That's right.
Wow. So wow, all these questions we have. What are the greatest concerns from covering all this do you have, David Sanger? What are the things that you're most afraid might happen next?
You know, it's not the big Pearl Harbor-style attack that brings down the electric grid, because the Russians and others know that would bring about a military response. It's the subtle manipulation of data. When you go to cast your vote, the fear that the vote will not be represented in the system the way you cast it, which is why it's so vital that all voting machines have a paper backup to them. It's your medical records. Imagine if somebody got into the military's medical database and ended up manipulating blood types. You can imagine the huge human toll that would take. It could be the manipulation of financial data. The North Koreans were pretty good at stealing $86 million from the Bangladeshi Central Bank. It would have been $1 billion had they not made a spelling error in one of the transfer documents. And again, that was done through cyber means. So it's the subtle stuff that can be most effective. And then in the information warfare side, as we learned from the Russians, it's those postings on Facebook that seem to come from your neighbor, but really came out of the Internet Research Agency in Russia.
Wow. So when you get right down to it, I mean, it's further evidence that you don't have to change a lot of things. You just have to move a few things around to get people to question reality or to actually make some physical changes that things go wrong because we make assumptions like your blood type is this.
Or to simply undermine their confidence in the systems that make their lives work. You know, supposing you get into your autonomously driven car to drive it to the supermarket and instead it drives you over a cliff.
Huh, okay. One really pleasant note to end on, but there's a lot of stuff that worth being concerned about, as David Sanger points out in his book.
The good news is we designed these systems. We ought to be able to fix them.
Ah, okay. That is a good place to end it. David Sanger, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book, The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Thank you, Jeff. Great to be with you.